Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
There's a new paper in town. It's called the Salisbury Independent. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Salisbury Independent began publication in May and is a weekly. And on May 29th, the paper featured an interview with Mayor Jim Ireton. The same edition, the public forum section, the editor and general manager, Greg Bassett, wrote that the paper wanted to, quote, truly be the community's newspaper to unite community causes and put the public in the know when it comes to what truly matters. And we have Greg Bassett in our studios. And I see, by the way, you just couldn't stay away from the newspaper business. Is that right?
I tried so hard, Don. I tried so hard to get out of it. But unfortunately, the business suits my personality. I'm nosy, love to gossip a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
People tell me I can write, and you've got those three talents, you're stuck.
I would say that's the only thing you can do.
Right, you've got to take information from people and run and tell.
That's right. Well, tell me a little bit about how did the concept of the Salisbury Independent come about?
Well, as many people might know, I was the longtime editor of the Daily Times, the daily newspaper here, the Gannett product in Salisbury, and with the footprint, the regional footprint of a regional daily newspaper. And as things changed in the newspaper business, suddenly I found myself without a position anywhere. And people, I looked for things other than journalism jobs, as you know, as you have seen and everyone has seen how the industry has contracted and changed so much just in the last 10 years. Disruptive innovation of the internet and what that's done to the content and how news is dispersed really seemed like there's not a big future in newspapers. But people would come to me and they would say, we miss the old kind of community newspaper. We miss the paper that celebrates our successes. It doesn't just tell us what's wrong with our community, which celebrates and sort of cherishes what makes our community special. So the idea came up to do a weekly. I did a business plan. I was able to get in with independent newspapers, a great national chain that specializes in community weekly newspapers, with the idea, their theory is sort of, they call it refrigerator news, the kind of news that you want to clip out and put on your refrigerator. So as an example, in this week's paper, we have 8 pages of graduation photos from the four county high schools. And it seems kind of hokey, you know, and it's not big breaking Pulitzer Prize winning news, but it's the kind of news that people love and they appreciate, and it reflects the positive stuff in our community.
So did you, what did you miss when you weren't in journalism?
I missed the idea of putting a product out every day and getting feedback. I missed the idea of writing a column and having people call and say, no, you got that all wrong, or, oh, I remember that too. I missed that back and forth with people, because people are really what it's all about.
That's right.
Issues are important, but the people are way beyond the issues. If you look at Salisbury in the last 20 years, the problems in Salisbury haven't been issues problems so much. It's been people problems. It's been people not working together, not communicating, maybe being selfish, you know, in the government, in the business, people not finding a way to get along. And I missed having some sort of a, not a role, but just sort of access to that kind of stuff. So when we started the Independent, the first person that I interviewed, I started a feature called the Q&A.
Right.
Where we try to interview a prominent newsmaker or public official or someone who just makes a difference in the community. And it's been amazing because they've allowed me to ask them really hard questions and they answer them. So I think we've built a, you know, maybe a reservoir of goodwill that we can tap on with these people. Our first subject was Jim Perdue. He told me things about his dad and the business, which I never had the courage to ask him in that daily format. But in the weekly format, I felt comfortable enough to engage him on some of these issues. And he gave some really interesting answers. It's been really a fascinating thing. And this week, I'm excited. I just did an interview yesterday with Palmer Gillis, who is a big local developer, to talk about his vision for downtown. He's got two big projects downtown right now, and we talked about that. And I just walked away just amazed to have access to ask this guy these questions. So my personality is that, and I think readers want to know this stuff. I think they want to hear what's positive in the community, what the challenges are, certainly, but still, what is good and what they can do to get involved.
Staying with just the interview format for just a moment, because we do this all the time, right? And one of the things I always found was that I would read something in the newspaper, and you could see the reporters rushing around, or even if it was some extended interview. But yet, when you got them in the studio, you seemed to get a lot more. Do you find that to be the case? That there, some, as opposed to that very tight stricture that we tend to have when we run out and cover the story and then run back?
Very much. This week, we profiled Phil Tillman,
right,
who was the longtime county council president. And Phil, in the context of 15 years ago when they implemented, I like to tease him, it's not a teasing matter, but I like to tease him, you know, the largest tax, property tax increase in the history of Wicomico County. When all that happened, I couldn't talk to Phil about those things. There was no way, because I was writing editorials every day criticizing the tax increase. And here we had a voter referendum situation where people were angry and they imposed the revenue cap because the county council had overreacted. And it took 14 years before I was really able to ask Phil, what happened then? What were you guys thinking? Was it a mistake? You know, did you do the right thing? So to have him as a questioner, he's got his own television show on Pac 14, but to put him on the spot like that and have him reflect on that all those years later, it was really an interesting discussion. But back then, I never could have asked him that because it was just so volatile at the time that he would have shut down. I think you almost need the specter of time to do that. And I think that's where I have an advantage because I know the community. I'm able to bring up stuff like that and ask those kind of questions. And people want to answer them. They want to talk about their failures or their challenges just as much as their successes.
Now, I mentioned a moment ago, you featured Jim Ireton, and who's had a very interesting history with the city, to say
yes,
the least. I'm sure he would agree, I think, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, he would.
You write of Ireton, you said, Ireton has a passion about Salisbury that is apparent at all times. Even his critics will say that though they oppose his methods, they admire his love for the city and his willingness to embrace its residents. What do you make of Jim Ireton? Now, you've actually seen him over a longer period of time, I think, than I have. When he first ran, great deal of controversy. I think the Daily Times actually endorsed him at one point.
We did.
And what do you make of his tenure? And it seems to me that in many ways, certain changes have taken place. I mean, am I wrong about that, as particularly as you interviewed him and you assess where he is?
Something's happened, and I'm not sure what it is. And the question I asked, he laughed hard at this question. I asked him about the drama. You know, you've certainly had your share of drama during your tenure. And, you know, it's the kind of thing, it could go either way when you ask question like that. You never know. You know, if I brought it up too soon, if I asked it out of context. And he did the sarcastic thing. He's like, drama? What drama? What are you talking about? You know, and you can hear him saying it. But certainly he has had his drama. But I get a sense now that he's working with people who at least are cooperative, that Jake Day's made a big difference on that council, that they're able to converse, that they're seeing things in a big picture instead of micromanaging what goes on in the mayor's office. So I see him more free to be himself and be the leader that he has the potential to be. I've known Jim Ireton since he was a teenager. When I worked at the Daily Times as a copy editor on the desk, he used to come into the paper at night and watch us put out the paper. He was that interested in what went on in the community. And I never imagined he'd ever be mayor.
Right.
But I don't always, maybe even rarely, agree with him on anything. But at the same time, you have to admire his passion. You know, he's still the mayor. You have to show him the respect because he's the mayor. I used to get so mad. You talk about Palmer Gillis in this mm-hmm. interview I just did. I used to go to council meetings, and he would yell at Barry Tillman. And I would say, Palmer, you can't yell at the mayor. Well, Greg, she's wrong. It doesn't matter. You just can't yell at the mayor. Rule one of life is don't yell at the mayor. You know, I would never yell at the mayor. So you get an environment like that. It's impossible, I think, or very difficult to be political. These guys aren't on Capitol Hill. They're friends and neighbors. They've got small businesses. It's just Salisbury. You know, it's not all about winning. I think it's about making the community better. So I think Jim gets that, and I hope he still gets that, and I hope the people who are on the council and surround him also get that.
I mean, because one of the things, as I looked at, you know, just in the 10 years that I've been here, is that there has been this contentiousness that on a constant basis, and the characters of the individuals seem to shift, but then it begins to break down. What is there something, as somebody asked me something the other day, is there something in the water? What is I mean, what is good? Particularly, you'll have people who are allies. I mean, Rachel Polk comes to my mind.
Right.
And then suddenly she's at odds with Barry Tillman. I mean, and this constant conflict. What is it?
I think
what's the dynamic?
I think just egos get involved. And anybody who's in a leadership position usually has an ego. It takes an ego to navigate those sort of waters. Rachel Polk and Barry Tillman always fascinated me because Barry Tillman would not have been reelected the mayor the first time if it wasn't for Rachel Polk's good work in District 1 and Von Siggers. That carried her to re-election. She actually lost the rest of the city, but she won the minority district in District 1 through the work of those people. But then it seemed like the mayor didn't understand that she owed anybody anything. Mm-hmm. They felt like they were owed something. She was a leader. She was definitely a leader. And it just brought all this derision. Plus, back then there were problems with the police department and leadership in the police department, a lot of questions. Council wanted to run the police department. The mayor wanted to run the police department. It's a classic scenario. But it just ended up with a lot of derision that wasn't necessary. People tell me all the time that down in Ocean City, that council used to really butt heads. So the newspaper was full of stories about people in Ocean City fighting. And in Ocean City, it changed because they did away with the non-residential voting.
Right.
And also, the kind of people that became council members, it used to be, the joke was, you had to own a boardwalk hotel to be on the city council in Ocean City. Well, people who had moved into town suddenly were on the council, and their mission and their ideas were a lot different. So there was a lot of good, interesting elbows under the basket, so to speak, down in Ocean City. Salisbury was quiet. Nothing ever happened. But somewhere there around 2002, when Mayor Martin retired, Barry Tillman came in as a neighborhood advocate, first woman who was mayor, a lot to prove, representing a whole different constituency. There became tension. She got a whole new council after her first term, or in the middle of her first term.
Right.
Or, yeah, at the yeah, their first term. And it wasn't any different. And then another whole council, and it wasn't any different. And even with Jim Ireton, a whole other council, it wasn't different. And the people, like with Von Siggers and Rachel Polk and Barry Tillman, that tension, allies who were enemies, not enemies, but certainly foes.
Right.
The same thing happened with Jim Ireton and the Terry Cohens and the Debbie Campbells. They became foes. It's just fascinating to watch these human beings interact. But like I said, they're human beings.
Oh, that's true. And if one interview's been long enough, you begin to understand that,
yeah.
I think. So how, when you, through this paper, how are you envisioning bringing this kind of thing into people's living rooms? The idea that they're, just give a fuller picture, I guess, as it is, of who these people are and the kinds of conflicts and the kinds of cooperation, for that matter, that we see.
Well, something we really worked hard on at the Daily Times was to make sure that the newspaper reflected the community that it serves. And that's not always easy to do, especially as the business changes and as communities change and as readership, their ideals sort of change. Not everyone wants to hear the positive news. A lot of times they're more attracted. They all look at the car crash. You know, they don't look at the flowers growing along the road.
Right.
But they'll all turn their head to the car crash. So that's sort of that idea that goes on. But people told me over and over again that they wanted, that they felt like the newspaper was sort of an alien in their hands. It didn't really match what they knew of the community. It didn't reflect the stuff that they worked on that mattered. And I don't pretend to compete at all with the Daily Times. They have their role. It's a great newspaper. They do a really good job. Their website is amazing. You know, and so they're doing their thing, and I'm going to do mine. And it's going to be true community news. It's going to be the fire department promotions and the Boy Scout inductions and the hospice fundraisers. I'm looking forward. This week we're going to have a photo page of the party that's taking place at the Civic Center for the big wrestling tournament. The professional wrestlers are in town. So, I mean, that's the kind of hokey thing that the Daily might or might not cover. I don't care, but we're going to have pictures of people from our community interacting with wrestlers in a social situation. And it could be a lot of fun. It could be a disaster, but it could be a lot of fun. So that's what we want to get to.
Pedro, I was going to ask you, how big a role do you see photographs playing? I mean, you talk about it, but I think in your editorial, you talked about the idea that newspapers are print, but they're also pictures. How do you see the role of photographs being played out in your publication?
Yeah, it's really important. And with the technology now, it's so different.
Yeah.
I mean, when I started, in order to get a job as a reporter, you basically had to have a camera and be able to work in a dark room. You had to be able to, yes, you know, to take care of your own photos. Now everyone can take excellent photos on their phone. So, and the public can contribute photos. We've run some very nice landscape photos that have been submitted from people, you know, in the community. And certainly any kind of a fundraiser or an event, people can take photos of themselves and just like they do on Facebook, and we'll put that in the paper, and people love to look at that. People, one of the universal things in newspapers, and I don't know if it's a secret or not, people love to read their name in the paper, and it's up to us to get it spelled correctly, right, which doesn't always happen, and they love to see their photos in the paper, and they love to see pictures of their friends. You know, it's like a scrapbook somehow, a community scrapbook. So photos are really important, names and faces, and just so the paper looks like the community that we serve. I think one of the problems with Wicomico is that maybe in the newspaper coverage around, you'll see lots of coverage from Ocean City. You'll see lots of coverage from the Western Shore, even like down in Virginia and Somerset County, Delaware, certainly a lot on television. Yes. Delaware is a big component to their coverage on television. But you don't always see the Salisbury coverage that you'd like. Salisbury seems to get left out sometimes.
Well, why do you think that is?
I think journalistically... I think journalistically that Salisbury isn't always that interesting. I mean, it's sort of the base, and you're here all the time, so you kind of get used to it. So you're not as intrigued by what goes on, maybe. You know, I know our problem, one of our problems at the Daily Times was that we covered Room 301 at the government office building to death, but we right. never got out in the neighborhoods and wrote the real good neighborhood stories like I thought that we needed to do, which is something that I want to do in this publication. I think, like, you just don't notice things around your house like you do at someone else's house the same way. I had a reporter that I hired one time say, why are all the high schools in this county on the same street? And I went, they are. There's three high schools within 2 miles of each other all on the same street. Now, I know how that happened, but it never occurred to me that that was unusual. You know, so you sort of need that outside thing, the outside influence looking at things. So I think those of us who live here might not cover the Salisbury with the same sort of exotic flair that we would the other communities. And you see this with the metros, where they parachute in, they write the big tell-all story from the community, and then they leave.
Right, you know? Exactly.
And they're not around for the ramifications. You know, all the reporters at the Sun or the Post want to write the definitive, you know, Purdue Farms is a terrible entity, you know, kind of thing to sort of make their career, even though we know it's not true, that what Purdue contributes to the community far outweighs anything that could be negative, and the stuff that comes up as negative is always dealt with. I mean, I'm always impressed by that. So, yeah, I just think that Salisbury just needs better community coverage.
So what role do you see the internet playing and your web presence, for that matter, in this publication?
Yeah, I don't know that I have the web solution exactly what I want. I mean, there's such a stretch or an emphasis on mobile right now.
Oh, yeah.
You know, we're four issues in, so I'm not quite... you know, I'm not doing the mobile platform like I would like. I'm trying to develop that. I don't know that many people know about our website yet. We haven't really marketed it like we would like because we're trying to get the paper right
first. Yeah.
Which is backwards from all the traditional thinking or the new thinking. You know, everything is web first, digital first, mobile first, and then at the end, you print the paper. I'm kind of going the wrong way on that, and we'll find out if that works or not. But our website's nice. I'm getting good feedback on it, but it's not as dynamic as I would like it to be. What you see now in journalism, just how things change so fast. There was a line the other day, someone was talking about blogs, you're going to have a blog, and someone else said, you know, blogs are so 2007. And it's true. You know, people don't read blogs obsessively like they did in 2007. So they're on to the next thing, whatever the next thing is. So I want to make sure I'm positioned for whatever the next thing is, whatever the new platform is, whatever people want to do, that we can get the content to them in a way that makes sense, that they can enjoy it. You know, these Q&As, they can take 15, 20 minutes to read. Most people don't have 15, 20 minutes to read something in the morning. So by creating this weekly product with a shelf life, you know, that someone can read it for 4 or 5 days, hopefully, and they'll get value out of it. They won't feel like that they're wasting newsprint by the paper stacking up. They're getting a little better experience from a print product versus the digital thing. You know, I tell everyone that, you know, I'm 53 years old, but the happiest I can ever be is if I have a tuna fish sandwich and a newspaper in front of me. I mean, that's just heaven to me. My son, who's 17, 18, he won't look at a newspaper unless he has to. There was a good example. His football team had some coverage in the Daily last year. Handed him the paper. I said, read this. And he sort of pushed the paper away. He's like, no. And he ran upstairs, got his laptop, and read the story on that. That's his preferred platform. So all those readers are out there. I think our demographic in Wicomico County, there's a couple things in our favor in terms of a weekly print product. One of those things is about 60% of the county, 55-60% of the county is age 45 and above. So those people are natural newspaper readers. And one of the weird things about this county and this SMSA is that the demographics are so much like America. I mean, in terms of the age breakdowns, the gender breakdown, income, this really is America in miniature in Salisbury. It's an amazing market. But where we fall down is connectivity online. Many people, vast majority, still get their online content via a web browser and usually at their work. We're still very underwired, so to speak, at people's houses. And you can see that at the Daily, where we track the web traffic, and people would look at the news at 8:30 in the morning when they arrived at work. They'd look at it at noon when they left for lunch. They'd look at it at 4 right before they would go home, and then traffic would go way down. And then about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, it would spike back up again because people, get into bed with their iPads or whatever, and they check things before they go to bed. But still, the last numbers I saw, it was only like 40% of people really are connected with Wi-Fi or the fast digital at their homes. So a paper product still makes sense for the demographics in this market.
So tell me a little bit about the other people at the paper, the publisher and so on, and some of the reporting. What kind of talent have you drawn on out of the community?
Well, it's funny. My first hire, there's really just two of us doing this right now.
It's
the smallest shop. I laughed that I went from having 141 employees 5 years ago to one.
Welcome to my world, right, but that's okay.
Exactly, right now. Susan Canfor is my reporter, and Susan and I have worked together since 1987. We were hired within 4 months of each other at the Daily Times right out of college. We competed with each other sort of career-wise. I have to say that I, went way past her. Sorry, I'm just kidding.
I'm sure I'll hear from her soon. But
and now we're back together, and Susan's terrific. Susan's one of those people that, to be a good reporter, you have to be someone that people will trust, and they'll tell you stuff, And you have to know how to be quiet and listen while they talk. And I'm being a blabbermouth here because you're interviewing me, but there's a subtle way of just sort of sitting back and getting the news and getting people to trust you. And Susan is really good at that. She never gets things wrong. When you read a newspaper, the more you know about an issue, the more errors you find in the newspaper. And she's very good at being, keeping it simple. The old KISS rule, keep it simple, stupid. Keeping it simple and writing it correctly, and really leaving a good trail wherever she goes with the people that she interviews. So I'm enjoying working with him, or with her. She's very good at deadlines. And it's a new world for both of us, but so far it's been a lot of fun.
So what do you see as the future of this publication? I mean, do you think that you're going to maintain it simply as a weekly, or if you have some success with it, wouldn't you expand it to, I think it's the Cape Gazette, I think comes out twice a week, that kind of thing. So there's that option too.
It's funny you mentioned the Cape Gazette. Dennis Forney, who runs the Cape Gazette, as someone who worked at Gannett, I competed with him for a long time.
Sure.
Growing up around here, I've read Dennis Forney's products since I was a little kid and admired his method, his model. And what Cape Gazette does up there in Lewis and Rehoboth, for people who might not know, is they basically print anything that anybody sends them, with the idea that if it's important to you, it's important to us. So they will share the news. I used to get frustrated reading their editorial pages because they would get like these letter writers on the same topic and they wouldn't let go. And I would be like, it's time to move on. And Dennis one time said, no, you have to let them keep chewing on that bone. Readers want to do that. They like that. They look for the next installment on this thing. So that is a great community newspaper. I would love to emulate that as much as possible. They're in a weird market with, tourists plus locals.
Right.
I'm going to be local. A friend of mine at the Daily Times actually said, you can be the from here paper and we're going to be the come here paper. You know, now I don't know if that's true, if that's going to be their model, or if it's just a joke. But, you know, I want to appeal to everybody because there are come-heres and from-heres who still need their community coverage. In terms of expanding, I have no idea. You know, we'll see how this goes. And we don't know what the next disruptive innovator is. I was just reading a thing, a technology of this plastic product where a digital newspaper can be displayed on this this digital plastic project product. So you have the sort of the paper experience while holding something that's still digital.
That's right.
Who knows what's going to happen?
So, by the way, I must ask you, so how do you assess the changes at the Daily Times? I mean, you were there for a long time, obviously. And when anybody comes in, whatever operation is, it changes and so on. What's your impression as you go away?
I'm really impressed. I think they do a really good job. And, you know, their mission is different than mine. Certainly, their readership's going to be different. Their approach is much more digital than mine. You know, I think you sort of see this idea that videos are a good way to tell stories, and I agree with that. But I'm not as video motivated. I'll watch television news, but for some reason, I don't want to wade through the commercials online and to see a video that might not be very good. I'm not saying their videos aren't good, but sometimes that happens, and you waste a lot of time. And with the connectivity around here, it's difficult to get videos before people and have it really be valuable, I think. But that's where they're putting a lot of their eggs. That could be the future, for all I know. You see these reporters, they call them mojos, mobile journalists, where they're using iPhones to record everything. And I have to admit, they had a story, a very good story, just yesterday, the day before, about the guy who was elected down in Princess Anne to the town council, UMS student. And I watched the video report on that. So I learned about that by seeing him. I wanted to see him talk, and I enjoyed the reporter's questions, and they were kind of yucking it up a little bit. And it was really an interesting and compelling experience, so I have to give them that. But I'm still old school. I'm still believing that what's old is new again. Mm-hmm. I still think the written word is the best way to communicate what goes on. And I think telling stories with photos and headlines and text is still viable, especially in this market. So I want to pursue that. But, you know, the Daily, you know, they're on their First Amendment thing, which is great.
Right.
We need that in the community. We need someone to ask the hard questions. They certainly have the resource to do that. So my hope is that they do their thing, and I'm going to do mine. And between the two of us, we're going to make the community better.
One of the things, by the way, you talk about the print as opposed to the video. One of the things that that I've always found, the contrast between I see something as print as opposed to, say, certainly in radio to hear somebody, is that print tends, and sometimes I think tends to drain the personality out of what is being quoted, and if you hear it, it's a much different experience. I mean, do you agree with that?
I would. I think all those different mediums are really, really interesting. You know, I grew up when there was sort of a revival in radio theater. CBS used to have a thing there in the mid 70s, where E.G. Marshall used to host it at 10 o'clock at night, and to hear stories told, you know, via words, and certainly what NPR does every day between All Things Considered and Morning Edition and Ira Glass and all, you know, the millions of things that I listen to, that radio experience is totally unique, and it's a completely different way to tell stories. Usually you're in your car.
That's true.
You know, or you're doing a podcast, you know, while you're working out or falling asleep at night, that kind of thing. So the platform that you're on when you're listening to that is a little bit different, but still, stories can definitely be told verbally. And some of the best journalism I've ever heard has been stuff that I hear, you know, on the radio. The NPR series they did on the border. That's one of those topics that I have very little patience for, because I just don't get the arguments sometimes about immigration, and I don't understand all the tension about it. Hearing that series changed how I thought about everything with that. So that's a power of radio. I don't think I could have read a piece in the Washington Post that would have had the same experience, or in a local newspaper, but certainly that radio experience made a big difference.
So looking at Salisbury, what do you see as the future? What kind of development? Obviously, you've emphasized a little bit about the downtown area, which is looks as if it's going to get a lot of attention. How do you see the future as opposed to what you've seen?
I'm banking and staking my career and my business, I'm a part of, on the idea that Salisbury is about to hit a renaissance, that the pieces are in place, that the economy is coming back, that there's an interest, that there's leadership here now, through the Chamber of Commerce and through the city government and through the service clubs. Salisbury has an amazing amount of service clubs. It has three Rotaries. The Salvation Army here is incredible. Just everywhere you look, there's some sort of a nonprofit. Coastal Hospice, is incredible. It just fascinates me. The Community Foundation, United Way. Our United Way is incredible. So there are all these people who aren't necessarily elected by anyone, but they're making a difference in the community, and they work hard every day. Chamber of Commerce, I see a complete difference in Chamber of Commerce. Just they're motivated. The leadership is young. Bradley Gillis was just the president. He's a kid, you know, and he has ideas that I would never have and notions that I would never have. He and his partner have taken over this the firehouse downtown.
That's right.
I would never have the courage to try to redevelop that thing, but they have the energy and the vision to do that, you know, and they're either going to succeed or they're going to fail. But I think Salisbury's about to have a renaissance. I think downtown's about to pop. We've heard forever that downtown's back, and it's never
right.
back.
Never back. You think this time it's it?
We have a column. My friend Mike Dunn wrote a good column this week. He says, this time it's for real. So we'll see.
Well, we're speaking with Greg Bassett. He is with the Salisbury Independent, a new publication just within the last month, I guess it is. And we're talking a little bit about the role he sees. And, of course, everybody is familiar with you because you were certainly with the Daily Times for a very, very long time.
Both good and bad.
I'm sure it's mostly.
It's not all milk and honey.
Anyway, I appreciate you stopping by and talking with us.
Thank you, Don. This has been fun. Thank you.
And this is Don Rush, and you've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, as they say, and we'll be back in a moment.
My name is Michael Park, and every week on the International Americana Music Show, I play a selection of the best Americana music made solely by non-American artists. Whether it's alt country from Australia, newgrass from Norway, or singer-songwriters from South Africa, there's music and interviews with Americana artists from lots of countries that may surprise you. So join me for the International Americana Music Show, Friday nights at 11 on WSDL 90.7.
Preparing for some summer fun? Jump right in with Delmarva Public Radio's Summer Online Auction. Items include surf lessons from Malibu's Surf Shop and a charter fishing trip from Lucky Break Charters in Ocean City, tea for two at the Channel Bass Inn in Chincoteague, handmade kindness bracelets, books, beach bags, and much more. Also check out the DPR Throwback Thursday bag full of fun, old-school DPR goodies that you haven't seen in years. The Summer Online Auction runs June 2nd through the 8th. Visit DelmarvaPublicRadio.net for more information. Happy bidding!
Wicomico County is now battling the highest rate of certain STDs in the state outside of Baltimore. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. Salisbury Times printed a major story this past Sunday that has many talking. It found that Wicomico County has the highest rates of chlamydia and gonorrhea among the counties in Maryland. And those high rates have spurred officials to form a task force to find strategies to fight these diseases, especially among young people. With us in the studio is Dr. James Cockey. He is the Deputy Health Officer for the Wicomico County Health Department. And welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, why don't you first of all give me a sense about how serious this is? What are the numbers telling us? What's the situation out there?
The numbers are telling us that Wicomico County, compared to the other counties in the state of Maryland, has and has had for many years unusually high rates of gonorrhea and chlamydia. The numbers throughout the country and also in the state of Maryland and in Wicomico County consistently show that the highest rates of those sexually transmitted infections are in the 20 to 24-year-old age group, and the second highest are in the 15 to 19. So we're talking about high school and college-age kids. The Wicomico and Somerset for the last 10 years have been among the highest consistently. When we are always looking at public health issues that where we can put some efforts to try to make an impact, and there's other public health initiatives going on here and all over the country. But we decided more than a year ago to put some efforts into this one, and there have been efforts going on forever, that most people have seen in billboards and posters and so forth. So we're looking for, in addition and on top of the ongoing efforts that have been done for many years, to come up with new strategies to try to make an intervention in this problem.
And now, over the last 10 years, as I understand it, we've got a situation where some of this has been fairly steady in terms of being high. Do we know whether or not before that decade, whether it was lower or...
We don't really have good data, going back before that. The state of Maryland has developed some very sophisticated data collection means that are pretty reliable and reproducible. But going back before that, we don't have reliable data. But going back the last 10 years, the chlamydia rates in Wicomico County and in Maryland and throughout the country are steadily rising. And there are, I'll go into that a little more detail, but the gonorrhea rates have not been changing dramatically. Right. And HIV rates and teenage pregnancy rates have not been dramatically going up. And in part, the chlamydia rates are related to more aggressive testing. Chlamydia and gonorrhea is commonly asymptomatic. So you can be infected with it and transmit the infection to a sexual partner, but be totally without symptoms. And the CDC recommends on a routine basis that asymptomatic women up to the age of 26 be tested for gonorrhea at least once, for chlamydia rather, at least once a year.
So why is it that we have this higher rate, especially this contrast between, say, chlamydia and gonorrhea on the one hand, and yet some of these other sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV? There seems to be a disparity here.
Yeah, there does, and I don't have a good explanation. Part of it has to do with the fact that chlamydia and gonorrhea are so common, so that when people do have multiple sexual partners or engage in unprotected sex, they're more likely to contract diseases which are already prevalent in the population. Fortunately, HIV and syphilis are less prevalent, and that has something to do with it. Why Wicomico has so high has puzzled many people, why our rates are so high. Nobody knows. To do a definitive scientific study of that is way beyond our capability and our financial means. Some of the theories were mentioned in the article in the Daily Times on Sunday. One of the theories is that Wicomico is at the crossroads of a lot of activity, including some illicit activity between Route 13 and Route 50. Another theory is that Wicomico is a relatively small county that has student population from three colleges. And we have student population from SU, obviously, and Warwick. And we have a lot of students at UMES that live in Wicomico. So that and this is in the highest risk age group, the 20 to 24 age group, so that the proportion of highest risk age group people to the total population is unusually high. That may contribute. And the proximity of Eastern Correctional Institute may contribute. People that wind up in jail tend to be at higher risk for multiple social problems, including STDs. And it is not uncommon for family members of the inmates to come and live in Salisbury and get a job so they can be close to their loved one. And it's also pretty common for when an ECI inmate is released, they're released into Salisbury. So those are just theories, but there's nothing definitive.
How does that contrast, say, for instance, to, say, a county like Somerset County, which obviously has a lower rate? I mean, what is the difference
there? It
has
a somewhat lower rate.
Yeah, somewhat lower, yeah.
Not dramatically lower. And the 2012 data, when Wicomico was the worst in the state for chlamydia and gonorrhea, is what got us moving on
right.
this. But for the last 10 years, you know, Somerset's up there pretty well, too.
Right.
And some years is ahead of Wicomico.
Now, these areas, is it the same for, say, Worcester and some of the lower shore, do we know?
Worcester tends not to have as much, and perhaps because the demographics of Worcester, it's a more affluent population. That may have something to do with, because these are diseases where the risk is higher in lower socioeconomic status, and it's also markedly higher, and this is true in Maryland, in Wicomico, and nationally, in African Americans. The incidence of gonorrhea and chlamydia is 5 to 10 times as high in African Americans than it is in whites.
Right, and so looking at some of the stats that we're talking about, and one of the things is that, like, the African American population, I guess, in Wicomico County is something like 42%.
I think it's
24%. How does that stand in contrast to Somerset County?
Somerset is much higher.
And
it's not clearly not totally a. These are all statistical associations, and they're not universal explanations. We really don't know why Wicomico is so high, and it clearly is not totally related to race.
Right. So when we're looking at this, how did you guys become aware of this? What was the impetus for this task force? Because obviously this has been a longstanding issue.
The state of Maryland over the last couple of years has developed particularly good data collection in a process known as the State Health Improvement Program. So we now get regular updates on 37 public health related parameters with reliable data, and you can compare it year by year and compare it how you stand with the rest of the counties. And I would say that the development of this sophisticated database is a major reason for looking at this. There's many public health initiatives going on in Wicomico. This is one of many. And any institution has only so much manpower and so much money, and you have to pick things that that need more attention and where you have a hope of making some inroads and that fits within your budgetary capabilities. Currently, Wicomico, and there's a lot of thinking goes into this. There is something called local health improvement coalitions. In the past, they were called community health teams, there's a local health community coalition in Wicomico, and every county, or sometimes multiple counties, do it together, and that includes representatives from hospitals, from education, from the general public, from law enforcement, from social services, and they get together and talk over what they feel like the major public health issues are locally, what activities are going on, and that generates plans. And also every 5 years, the Lower Shore does a major community health assessment that's done by surveys. It's pretty expensive, and it's done. It's paid for, and the data is shared between Worcester, Wicomico, and Somerset County Health Departments, and also PRMC, AGH, and McCready Hospitals.
So what are the solutions? And I mean, one of the things that I noticed in the piece was that you're trying to find solutions that don't necessarily divide the community. And this
Absolutely.
Is obviously a touchy issue. How are you approaching this?
And that involved our task force, which again is made up of representatives of multiple different institutions. And in general, you don't get much done in public health unless you form collaborations with other stakeholders. But our task force, initially in looking at the question of reducing STI incidents, focused on two sort of obvious ones that everybody thinks of that under scrutiny don't really work as well as we expected. The first was condoms. And gee, if we can just get more condoms out there, people will use them, and this will help. Well, it turns out we distributed amazing numbers of condoms. The health department, through various departments in Wicomico, distributes 17,000 condoms a month. The TLC is now also distributing condoms. The SU Student Health is very aggressive in pushing condoms, and still we have the problem. And it's fairly clear that these condoms that are so aggressively distributed are not routinely used. So condoms are certainly helpful when they're used appropriately. The reality is they frequently aren't used or are not used appropriately. The other sort of knee-jerk, obvious approach is education. And when we went into this, we were under the impression that if we just had the right educational program, educational curriculum in the public schools, that we'd make a big impact. And when we studied the literature and experience around the country, and we also talked directly with representatives of the Board of Ed, we came to the opinion that that was false, that there is no right more effective curriculum. It doesn't exist. There's no evidence for one. And also, if you take a strong position about curriculum, and the basic social division on that is there are some people that argue that the only thing that should be advocated is abstinence. There are some people that argue that, well, abstinence is great, but it's not realistic, and that you have to focus on education about risk reduction, including condoms. And for the last perhaps 30 years, particularly centered around HIV, those camps tend to not listen to each other and not get along very well. And we became real clear early on in our process that that was not at all useful to tackling the problem locally. And we wanted to collaborate with the Board of Ed. We don't want to antagonize anybody. The Board of Ed reflects the prevailing social norms in this area, and we want to work with that. We want to engage everybody. So the strategy that we eventually formulated was to try to aggressively make the public aware in Wicomico County that we have a serious problem. And we're trying to do that in multiple different avenues, and the Daily Times article was the first, and this is another, and there's other ones going on, that we have a serious problem affecting our kids and their future, and it's something that we hope that everyone will own. And in owning it, we'll engage in discussions with kids, with each other, with Board of Ed, with public health, and we'll engage in trying to deal with it. And in doing so, we have some more specific strategies that we hold up and we're trying to implement. But in working out those strategies, we very much don't want to antagonize anybody. There's no right approach. There's no wrong approach. We want everyone at the same table talking to each other and engaging with the issue. And our hope is that in doing that, we'll get diminished STI incidents.
Because as I was reading, when one program, there's an abstinence that's being taught, say, in the middle schools, but at the same time, there's also teaching, I guess, in the 10th grades about contraception and birth control. How do parents respond? I mean, how are you taking this approach? Because there are some parents who would, say, strongly advocate, for instance, the teaching of, say, contraceptives. On the other hand, others won't, and obviously there's also a strong push and pull in terms of abstinence. I mean, how do you, talking to the parents, what's going on here?
At this point, we have not been engaged directly with parents at all. Mm-hmm. We have had limited engagement with the students themselves. We did do one presentation with the Wicomico County Board of Ed Health Advisory Council, which includes some students. We've been mostly working within ourselves. And part of our plan is to engage more publicly. I think the best answer to the question you just asked is reflected in our engagement with Board of Ed, which to some extent represents the parents in the community. And the Board of Ed has been responsive and engaged and is working together with us. One of our strategic plans is we're developing speakers bureau that will go out and talk to whatever groups, churches, or whoever wants to talk with us. But at this point, we haven't engaged directly with parent groups, and our goal is to push the information out there and the notion that we all have a problem for our young people that can affect their health now, can affect their health in the future, making them infertile, causing problems that can lead to emergency hysterectomies that increases the risk of HIV infection. And we hope to have everyone owning that problem and engaging with each other about ways of doing better with it.
Have you got any indication as to how the Board of Education has reached out to parents or to students?
Well, we're relatively early in this process.
Okay, yeah,
We have some wonderful representation from the board with Michael Charlton, who's mm-hmm. in charge of health education, and Diane Pellegrino, who's the nursing supervisor for Wicomico County Board of Ed, and they've been wonderfully helpful, and they are intermediaries with the Board of Ed in general and with any plans that we will develop in the future. We also have had a longstanding relationship in the health department's prevention department with a wonderful outreach worker and educator named Shavonda Carr, who has always been invited in to Wicomico County Schools to address the issues of STIs, and she always respects the rules of the Board of Ed. But we have made that relationship closer. So Shavonda routinely meets with the Wicomico County health educators, and they exchange ideas and plans and are working more collaboratively than in the past, but it's always been a good relationship.
So how optimistic are you that this effort that you're putting out there, and obviously you're at the beginning of it, at least in terms of the task force, is going to see some fruit? I mean, given the oddity of the situation that you described to begin with.
I am reasonably optimistic, and in public health, small changes are successes. You know, if we can reduce the rate of chlamydia and gonorrhea 5% in a year, that's a success. I think getting the information out there, getting people talking and thinking and interacting will have some effect. Getting kids more conscious that it really is pretty common and that it can be asymptomatic and you can very easily spread it is going to help. There's a lot of really extraordinary web-based tools that have been developed to address this question, because these STIs are a problem all over the country. And we are in the process of implementing and promoting those web-based tools that make it easier to communicate. There's one wonderful program where if a person is diagnosed with chlamydia and they're afraid to tell their partner or partners, site can give them scripts and ways of discussing it, either in person, by telephone, by email, by tweet, or if they can't, if they're afraid to do any of those, they can send an email to the program, which then sends an email to the person in question, saying that, you know, you may have been exposed to chlamydia and you should get evaluated, and here's where you can go. And nothing ties that with the person. So there's some really creative, sophisticated web-based programs that are out there that we will be seeking to implement. And we were very happy to have the Daily Times article on Sunday. At the same time, our strategic plan did not have that happening in June of this year. We had hoped to have everything else fully developed, so when we went into this public campaign, we'd have all the things that we want to implement readily available and readily accessible, and have our whole promotional campaign in place. So it didn't quite fit our schedule, but we're glad it's out there, and now we're rolling with it.
So is there then still this sort of embarrassment then about these diseases? And is there, particularly amongst young people, is there a certain invincibility or a certain sense that anything can be cured, I guess, with the exception of HIV? I mean, what is there?
I think any people, and particularly young people, very definitely are embarrassed and don't want to acknowledge it. If a young person has been in a relationship with one other person and they find they're infected, it's very, very hurtful that someone they trusted totally has been with someone else and has caused them infection. So, yeah, embarrassment is a major issue for most kids. There are some kids that have been in our clinic so many times that they do feel invincible. It's readily treated and cured, and they don't really feel a great deal of motivation. And I think the success in treating many diseases, including chlamydia and gonorrhea, has created the sense that these are trivial diseases. And that is perfectly understandable. Young people can routinely get treated for diseases and rarely get in trouble. And it's very understandable that they would not take them terribly seriously. We want them to take them seriously. Part of our education campaign has been and will continue to be of the bad things that can happen and the situations in which they're not so readily curable. The presence of either partner with any STI increases the transmission of other diseases. And for instance, HIV does not routinely get transmitted with every sexual act. If either partner has an STI, the efficiency of transmission goes way up. So that's part of the danger. Another one is that it's not uncommon to have asymptomatic infections to pass it to other people, and also to develop serious infections, abscesses in women in the genital tract that can lead to emergency surgery, emergency hysterectomy, that can leave a girl permanently infertile. And these are problems that really do happen. They don't generally happen right at the time when the young person has had the infection. So those are things that we're trying to and have been and will continue to have young people be aware of. And we are also in a situation where there's information overload for everybody, including young people, and young people have many adults, parents, schools, public health, police, giving them all sorts of messages, and it's fairly easy to tune it all out. And we're trying to get a better understanding of the thinking in young that young people have about these issues, and we're also doing this with other related issues like drug and alcohol abuse, and get a better understanding of messages that might stick with them and have more of an effect than the messages we have used in the past.
What about the relationship of parents to these kids? Is there a reluctance to talk about it? I mean, is it less pronounced now than say it was say 20 or 30, 40 years ago? What sense do you get?
I have no insight to that, and I have no data about that. I can't respond to that. I can respond to it as a parent, and my wife and I raised three children, and I was pretty comfortable talking about it with my son, and I didn't touch it with my daughters.
You let your wife take care of that? Okay. You think that's fairly common?
I just don't know. I have no insider data on that. It's an interesting question. It doesn't really affect our efforts.
Right.
Our efforts are based on pushing this this information out there and making people aware that we have a big problem. We have a worse problem than Baltimore County, a worse problem than Prince George's County, a worse problem than Somerset County. What are we going to do about it? And then when people start thinking about that, we're trying to avoid the knee-jerk reaction of abstinence or of condoms and better education. We're trying to get people working together to take it seriously. Simply talking about it and caring about it and knowing it's an issue, I think, is a huge step.
So particularly for young people, because we talked about the fact that there may not be symptoms, you know, certainly immediately for these two diseases. So what do you recommend in terms of what young people should do and what should they be looking for in terms of symptoms?
In terms of what to do, there's nothing new here, and there's been public health messages for many decades, and they really haven't changed. Abstinence is clearly the best way to avoid any sexually transmitted infection. If a young person is going to be sexually active, and the data is pretty reliable that by age 17, 50% of, a little higher than 50% and around 50% of, higher than 50% of males and a little bit higher than, around 50% of females have been sexually active, and it goes up from there. So the data is pretty convincing that it does happen. But so for those who are sexually active, there's some notions that we emphasize over and over and over again. One of them is be selective on who you're with. Stay with one partner. Another one is using protection. Another one that's probably one of the most important is to avoid being under the influence of drugs or alcohol when you're getting into a relationship. And that's one of the most dangerous times, when kids are at a party, they get drunk, they get high, and they become sexually intimate with somebody at a point where they're not in a good position to make good choices or to take appropriate protection. And the other one is if they have symptoms, it's easy to get checked at the health department. There's another web-based program where you can actually get checked at home. You can go online, order a kit with instructions, mail it back in, get our results electronically. I'm telling you where to go. There's some amazingly sophisticated things out there that we're in the process of getting out there to promote. The kids that get sick from it always seek help. If you have terrible discharge as a woman, or if you're having pus coming out of your penis and it's very painful to urinate, those people seek out help either in the health department or the emergency room.
So at this point, so what is the plan and the schedule in terms of, yeah, I mean, obviously the time sort of jumped the gun is, but right. But what's the kind of rollout? What kinds of things are you thinking about rolling out as you go forward here?
The one has already been accomplished to get a better relationship, a closer working relationship between the health department and the Board of Ed. Another one, the Daily Times and a program, and this program is addressing to impress on the whole community that this is an issue and engage people in talking about it. We would like, we hope, and this is still in process of working out, that the Board of Ed could partner with us in messages to students and to parents that this problem is out there, just again to get more in engagement. We are doing developing focus groups with various groups of parents and of young people in Wicomico County, trying to get a better understanding of attitudes about sexual activity and about drug and alcohol use. We have been pushing condoms as always, and we have had some new condom distribution points. We are trying to develop and take better use of internet facilities with some of the programs I have talked about in the last few minutes, and to find ways of getting those into kids, making them available using social media, using Facebook, using Twitter, using QR readers so they can quickly access reliable information. And that's all being worked on and is not finalized at this point.
We've been speaking with Dr. James Conkey. He's the Deputy Health Officer for Wicomico County Health Department about the high rates of chlamydia and gonorrhea in Wicomico County, the highest rates actually amongst the counties in Maryland. And we appreciate you taking the time to stop by and talk with us.
It's been a pleasure.
You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.